Dr. Mahan has explained that the compulsion to intervene in childbirth is actually producing a generation of reproductive cripples in the United States, women who have invasive procedures during one pregnancy and are then crippled and less able to have a healthy pregnancy in the future. I will build on that. I also want you all to know, in case you think this might be a conspiracy, we have four people. One's an obstetrician, and he talked about the problems with over-medicalization of maternity care, and then we're going to go from that dour outlook to having three women midwives who are all going to describe innovations and success stories, shining lights on cost-effective, proven ways to make pregnancy and childbirth safer for women, as well as their current and future babies. You have a handout, and I think it's got a bunch of tables on it. You don't have to look at them right now. Charlie pointed out that birth is rising low birth weight and preterm birth rates, and we have high neonatal mortality and morbidity, very high among comparable countries in the world, and rising maternal mortality and morbidity. And that suggests that it's time to stop digging the hole even deeper and to regroup, reorganize, and move in a different direction. I'll begin by describing one very successful innovation of prenatal and postpartum care, and one innovation for care during labor and delivery. The centering pregnancy model replaces individual prenatal care by 10 two-hour sessions in which two group leaders, one of whom is the group clinician, work with and join a group of 8 to 10 pregnant women with similar due dates. And the women and the two leaders progress through their pregnancies together. An interactive, mutually supportive group of women is at the core of the model, which both the Harvard Business Review and the Milbank Quarterly have described as a disruptive redesign of U.S. prenatal care. I believe that they use the term disruptive to be taken as positive in this case. The other innovation is not actually new. Actually, nitrous oxide has been used for women during labor for 100 years. But what is new is an attempt to reintroduce nitrous oxide in order to provide an alternative to epidurals as essentially the only effective means of analgesia that is currently being offered to women during labor in this country. Nitrous oxide is an old, off-patent, inexpensive analgesic that is not highly potent, but is potent enough for most women and is the safest means of obstetric analgesia outside of non-pharmacologic methods. Because of its safety, women who use nitrous oxide do not have to have routine use of intensive monitoring or frequent use of complication-causing procedures to treat complications that are attributable to the means of analgesia. A woman using nitrous oxide does not need to be tied to her bed by tubes and cords, and thus she can walk, go to the bathroom, garner all the benefits that accrue from freedom of movement during labor, and even use nitrous oxide in the bath, which they do in England. Women administer it to themselves, control when and how long they use it, and they can start and stop using it at any point, which is extremely different from an epidural, which once it's on board, you are stuck with it. It doesn't slow labor or prevent the baby's head from rotating in an ideal position for birth, and thus does not increase the need for either cesarean sections or surgically assisted vaginal births by using force applied by vacuum or forceps to budge a baby that's in the wrong position and is therefore stuck in the birth canal. Nitrous oxide is widely used in most other countries, but it has been removed from use, even banned from all but a few leading light academic hospitals in the U.S., actually two, I think, since introduction of epidurals. Some of us are trying to increase access to its use here. I'll return to that, but prenatal care and centering pregnancy come first. The centering pregnancy model of group prenatal care was developed by Sharon Schindler Rising, who is a midwife. Because the model replaces brief, task-oriented individual prenatal visits, average length 15 minutes, with long, intensive group sessions, each woman who participates in the Centering Pregnancy Program has 20 hours of highly personal interaction with her prenatal clinician and a bonded group of women from her own community, all of whom are active learners during a period of enormous personal transition, which is what pregnancy is. This contrasts with usual prenatal care, in which most visits are scheduled for 15 minutes, a total of less than 3 hours of contact between a pregnant woman and her prenatal clinician. Women are invited to participate in a centering pregnancy group at the conclusion of an initial comprehensive pregnancy assessment. Most are 3 to 4 months pregnant at the time of their first group session. The program follows the prenatal visit schedule recommended by the American Academy of Pediatrics and the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists. Group meetings are billed as prenatal visits using standard billing systems. Each group has 2 leaders, one either a midwife, physician, or nurse practitioner, and a group leader, usually a nurse, and another group leader, usually a nurse, who has had special training in the centering pregnancy group process. Group leaders must commit to participating in all 10 group sessions, and the entire schedule for all 10 is determined at the first meeting so that everyone can schedule and it's not necessary for people to miss sessions. Some groups meet in the late afternoons or evenings. They usually consist of women who work, and there are groups for just women, for just teenagers. Healthy refreshments are available during the period in which the group gathers and socializes at the beginning of each session, during which time each woman also weighs herself, takes her own blood pressure, tests her urine if necessary, and records her findings in her record. Women have complete access to, contribute to, refer to, and use their own maternity care records. Each session has an overall plan that addresses specific core content. At the beginning of each session, each woman completes a self-assessment that helps her identify her own needs and concerns relative to the subject of that particular session. The group is conducted in a circle in which every member's contributions are honored and every member is equal. The facilitator adjusts the plan content to allow full discussion of issues, information, problems, and examples shared by members of the group. Group members learn to provide active support and problem solving for and with each other. Involvement of family members or other support people is optional, and each group basically makes its own rules. Groups consisting entirely of teens take advantage of the adolescents' need to socialize with peers and preference for very interactive learning. Each woman leaves the group for a short time during each session to be examined and have private interaction with a clinician in a screened-off area within the space. So if we were having a session in this space, there might be a little curtain over there and a mattress on the floor and the doctor or midwife doing the little few things that you need to do as a physical exam. But they don't leave and go into the mysterious clinic. It's really all part of the group session. In some sites, as I said, it's just a curtain separating a mattress on the floor. The clinician answers any private questions but may encourage the woman to also raise her questions to the entire group. The group is the thing. Several studies have been conducted to evaluate the model. The largest, most rigorous, and most recently published of these was a multi-site randomized controlled trial involving more than 1,000 women who received care at hospitals affiliated with Emory University in Atlanta and Yale University in New Haven. The study was conducted by a multidisciplinary research team led by epidemiologists at Yale School of Public Health as well as the MDs and midwives on the faculties of Emory and Yale's Course of Midwifery and Nursing, and Sharon Rising. It was published in the August 2007 issue of Obstetrics and Gynecology. The mean age of the study participants was a little more than 20. 80% were African American. There were no differences between the centering pregnancy and control groups in age, parity, education, or economic status. Women randomized to group care were significantly less likely to have preterm births, 10% compared with 14%, which is a reduction of one-third. Women randomized, this is a randomized controlled trial, statistically significant differences. Women randomized to group prenatal care were also significantly less likely to have suboptimal prenatal knowledge. They felt more ready for labor and delivery, had greater satisfaction with the care they received, and were more likely to breastfeed. There were no significant differences in the percent of low birth weight babies. However, that was treated as a dichotomous variable. You were either low birth weight or not low birth weight. And so they didn't really measure, you know, differences in birth weight per se. And there were no differences in the cost of prenatal care, but the cost did not factor in rehospitalization or the additional care needed by low birth weight babies. It was just the cost of providing prenatal care. I'm missing something which told about which gave information on the pregnancy centering pregnancy center that Sharon Rising runs, and gives an email on how to reach her. I'm sorry, that seems to be missing. There are more. She has a center in New Jersey, Connecticut, and more than 200 centering pregnancy programs have been started in the U.S. So it's sort of a franchise. And the March of Dimes does provide support from beginning many of these centering pregnancy programs. And now to nitrous oxide, which I have a special interest in. After prenatal care comes labor and delivery, and pain is the first thing that most American women think of when they envision being in labor and delivering their baby. And they tend to think of it as possibly unbearable pain that overwhelms them and makes them lose control. Obstetric anesthesiology was developed as a subspecialty of anesthesiology in the 1970s. Now, more than three-fourths of women have epidurals in the United States, and the percentage is increasing every year. Most American women now think of an epidural as their salvation when facing the prospect of labor and giving birth. That is not the case in most other countries, where women have long relied on nitrous oxide, otherwise known as laughing gas, which is mixed half and half with oxygen and is administered by the woman to herself through a face mask or mouth tube during the hardest contractions. She's not using it all the time. I know that this sounds arcane, but it is available to virtually every woman during labor in most of the provinces of Canada, in all the Scandinavian countries, Israel, Australia, New Zealand, and the UK. It's used by at least two-thirds of women in the UK, most of whom say afterwards that they were satisfied and that nitrous oxide was enough for them. But many women are willing, well, women are afraid of terrible pain, overwhelming pain, and losing it during labor. But many women are willing to tolerate some pain and want to be fully involved and challenged and able to meet the physical challenge of giving birth. So long as they have support, and if some relief is, they know that some relief will be available if they really need it. This, of course, is not true of all women. Some women decide they want an epidural before they stop taking their birth control pills. But some women really don't want an epidural because they want to experience and participate in labor as fully as possible. They don't want to do anything that could hurt either the baby or themselves, and they really want to avoid a cesarean section. Having an epidural decreases the chance that a woman can deliver her baby spontaneously and increases the risk of needing either a cesarean section or use of forceps or vacuum to pull the baby out. If you have a handout, I think everybody has a handout. It includes 4 pages of bulletin summaries of information about the use, effectiveness, benefits, and risks of 4 major methods to help women deal with labor pain. I don't have time to go over every bullet on all 4 methods, but I'll try to hit the most important points. The first table summarizes information on opioid narcotics during labor, which were used by 22% of women who gave birth in American hospitals in 2005. Narcotics readily cross the placenta and are eliminated from the blood of both the mother and fetus by the liver. The fetus has an immature liver, and so by the time the mother has metabolized her narcotics and says, hey, I need more, the baby is really looped. And that can be a big problem. Opioids depress respirations. Naloxone is a drug that counters that effect. I'm sorry, I should have done this earlier. Naloxone must be available at the birth of any baby whose mother was given opioids during labor. Because of general depressive effects on the newborn, opioids also tend to delay effective breastfeeding. The next table summarizes information on epidurals, which were used by more than 3/4 of American women in 2005. Some hospitals have basically organized their routine obstetric care around the premise that every woman needs and should have an epidural. Epidurals have a very powerful effect on labor pain, but they also have a very powerful effect on labor, including complications for the baby and diminished effectiveness of contractions. And when the baby's head is coming down through the birth canal, a relaxation of the pelvic floor so that the baby's head doesn't go through the birth canal in the most efficient way and is more likely to get stuck, which is why you end up with more C-sections. I'm going to go past this. This is all on your page, and she says I only have 3 minutes. And so the next table is about nitrous oxide. It's quick and easy to start up and take effect. It's inexpensive. You use it, and within 50 seconds, you have pain relief. It's eliminated quickly through the lungs, bring it into the lungs, couple of breaths, and it's gone. Does not accumulate in the body. It's very safe for both the mother and the baby. Does not repress respirations. Does not affect the normal physiology of labor. There are 3 concerns, and they have been, in a sort of a red herring way, used to really dissuade people from this new effort to restart nitrous oxide. It affects vitamin B12 metabolism. Vitamin B12 is an essential part of cell division. It can cause occupational risks due to chronic exposure, and it's a global warming gas. The problems of vitamin B12 metabolism are most common in people who are chronic abusers. It's used as a recreational drug, both by kids who get it and go to concerts and use it, and by some doctors and dentists who use it. It's not nearly as severe as the problem of professionals using opioids. And there are some people who have inborn deficits of being able to utilize it. Again, I'm not going to go into all of these things, but the occupational risks were based on not having good OSHA standards or NIOSH standards. We have them if they're used. New data has not shown any occupational risks when the correct equipment is used in modern hospitals. The main man-influenced sources, it is a global warming drug, but most of nitrous oxide in the atmosphere comes from natural sources. Even trees produce it. And the main man-influenced sources are the same old use of fossil fuels, nitrogen-based fertilizers, and human and animal waste. Medical, obstetric, and dental uses are very small. The last page of the handout summarizes information about non-pharmacologic methods, and the only thing I'll say about that, and somehow that didn't seem to be here, but the only thing I'll say about that is that they're safe, and they are somewhat effective in relieving pain, but most American women are not willing to go with just non-pharmacological. And because of that, epidurals have become the hegemonic method in America, and they are having the effect that basically most women who go into a hospital cannot have a physiologic labor and delivery. We need to offer something that is more effective than the non-pharmacologic methods, although we also need to be able to provide them better and that does not interfere with the normal physiology of labor. I have started a website for people who are interested in learning more about and advancing access to nitrous oxide. And I will tell you my email address if you're interested. It's jprooks, R-O-O-K-S, 1, Arabic 1, at comcast.net. So if you're interested in this, send me an email, and I'll put you on the list. Vanderbilt Hospital is considering adding nitrous oxide. This will be a 50% increase in the number of hospitals. And there are a number of other hospitals that are going through the steps of trying to get it accepted. Thank you.
Eunice K. Kitty Ernst received the Martha May Elliott Award for exceptional service to mothers and children in 1981. Also a nurse midwife and with a master's degree in public health, she is currently director of the National Association of Childbearing Centers the Mary Breckenridge Chair of Midwifery at the Frontier School of Midwifery and Family Nursing, and president of the American College of Nurse Midwives for the second time. First, she was the youngest president in 1961, and then the oldest in 2007. She has been the prime leader in the effort to bring birth centers into the mainstream of healthcare delivery, and was founding director of both the National Association of Childbearing Centers, now known as the American Association of Birth Centers, and the Community-Based Nurse Midwifery Education Program, CNEP, along with pioneering many more educational and public health projects. Kitty has been honored with numerous awards, and her achievements in advancing the health of mothers and infants over 41 years are legion and extraordinary.
All right, I'm going to go fast and furious, and I want to pound a message into you because I don't want you to leave here without it. I would like to address the need for integrating midwifery care in our system of care in our system of care, period, for women and childbearing families. The evidence for doing this has been before us since those first studies of the Frontier Nursing Service and Maternity Center Association almost 80 years ago. That's why I have to pound it in. I want you to turn up your hearing aids so you can all hear me. The research on midwifery care provided in every setting, and in every population is irrefutable. Yet its implementation is still resisted at every turn. Why? Why is it that midwife, a word that simply means with woman, is so contentious in our society? We are really not bad folks when you get to know us. Are we, Charlie? I don't have the answer for that, but I do know that if we don't do something about it, you will not fix the healthcare system. Now, I'm absolutely convinced of that, and I'll tell you why. I'll give you three reasons why. One, the lack of substantial support for midwifery education, which includes attention to the barriers which have us for almost 80 years of demonstration and evaluation ad nauseum. We are still only at 6,000 to 7,000 practicing nurse midwives when we should have a minimum of 50,000. Well, actually, my friends from Sweden say, why, we have more than 50,000, you need 300,000. In spite of a growth in the number of education programs and the development of alternative pathways to midwifery education, midwifery cannot be part of the solution of healthcare reform if we cannot produce them. Now, you already know how old I am, or you've deduced it anyway. And I have been saying this all of my life. And so you do it now, or I'm going to die and pester you from above. In spite of the growth in the number of education programs and the development of alternative pathways, I said that. We can't produce them. And we cannot produce them when access to clinical training sites is restricted. It's a strange paradox that we lament our rising cesarean section rate, but we import foreign-trained physicians to fill our OB residency programs to be trained as surgeons. Be all right if they were trained as midwives. While restricting access to clinical sites for midwifery education to the point that the only way midwifery will be able to grow is to export American midwifery students to foreign soil for their clinical training. Now, what makes sense about that? I believe that everything in America runs on the dollar. So to change this, we must change the flow of money that supports it. Now, a lot of you sitting here control those flows of money, so listen to me. The flow of money to obstetric and midwifery training programs needs to be in a ratio to match the ratio of uncomplicated pregnancy and birth to the need for medical surgical intervention of the population served, a ratio of about one obstetrician to four or five midwives. Furthermore, clinical sites need to be educating teams of midwives and surgical specialists to work together. JCHO has discovered that that's at the root cause of a lot of our problems, and they're trying to put teams together, but if we don't train them together, they're never going to get together. You watch professional football on Sunday afternoon. If those teams didn't train together, they would be running all over the field. They might even run up into the grandstand with the football, thinking they were going to score a point. You have to train together. Furthermore, clinical sites need to be educating teams of midwives and surgical specialists to work together for as long as we prepare surgeons and midwives in ratios of 6 surgeons to 1 midwife. 6 surgeons to 1 midwife to manage the care of pregnancy and birth in this country. We will continue down the path as a surgical event for birth with all the yet to be discovered inherent problems and the cost that that signals. And then we'll blame the women for choosing it. Number 2, we need better and more current and long-term information on safety, satisfaction, and savings on the delivery of maternity care to childbearing families in all settings. The Cochrane Review, and you've got to get over this thing that all settings cannot be available just because you only know about the acute care hospital. Go out and learn about the other settings. The Cochrane Review states that the mother should be able to choose her place of birth. It is the responsibility of the system to work out a plan to respond to unforeseen events in childbirth. It's the responsibility of the system. You health departments in your regulations, you hospitals in the way you receive people in emergency rooms. It's up to you to make that transition smooth for the mother. A case in point, I had a life-threatening accident a few years ago. Well, actually about 25 years ago. My orthopedic surgeon did not tell me, maybe because he knew he wouldn't get away with it, that I should now drive with an ambulance and 2 medics in tow in case it should happen again. And yet that's what we do in obstetrics. That's what we do to mothers. We pump them full of fear. We need to study birth in all settings of the mother's choice. To that end, the new AABC uniform data set, which was presented here to a very small audience, not enough people interested in, they should be, is designed to study pregnancy and childbirth in all settings by all providers. It's a ready tool to be used for ongoing collection of more comprehensive and meaningful data on the events of childbirth. There's more going on in that childbearing year than the birth. Or at least there should be. We're in an information age, and we must do more to disseminate current and reliable information to childbearing families on normal birth so that they can make appropriate decisions. Number 3, I strongly believe, and I hope you will concur, that if we start at the beginning, capitalized, at the beginning in our efforts for healthcare reform, the beginning of a family, for the family is the cornerstone of every civilized society. We will see a domino effect in the better utilization of the rest of the healthcare delivery system. It's generally accepted fact that women make almost all of the decisions relating to healthcare for the family. Pregnancy is a logical time to intervene with our efforts to change the healthcare delivery system because it is a time when women are the most open to making changes in their lives and the lives of their families. The energy and motivation of those precious months are presently squandered on waiting room floors and in and out screening for problems because that is what physicians who provide most of the care are trained to do. Look for and fix problems. But midwives also know how to look for problems, and they know how to work with physicians to fix them. And it costs less when they do it. Pregnancy needs to be a time of remedial education, recognizing that most women and men today have not been taught about pregnancy, birth, breastfeeding, nurturing the growth and development of the young, nor do most women have an enlarged family to support them Women are often 3,000 miles away from their mothers and their sisters and their aunts. They're alone in New York and Philadelphia and Baltimore. Bill Cosby makes a strong case for this people support for parenting in his book, Come On, People, when he's trying to get you fathers and mothers to dialogue with one another about their problems and about how to solve them. So come on, people. The knowledge of parents should perhaps be assessed during pregnancy and remedial education required before you as a provider will be paid for the care you give. Everything moves on the dollar. Time and education intensive care has been a hallmark of midwifery care and childbirth, albeit not as midwives are currently allowed to practice in the medical domain of the acute care setting of today, but it's certainly found in the out-of-hospital settings like the one you're going to hear from next. The productivity schedules designed for the in-and-out care of the surgical specialist cannot be applied to the midwifery model of care, as the Developing Family Center and other birth centers have demonstrated. It is also past time to look at potential long-term results, some of them Charlie has referred to already, of what we are currently doing for the individual woman, for her baby, for her family, and for society as a whole. We are going to reap what we are sowing. Longitudinal studies are needed, and they require extraordinary collaboration of all providers. Now, collaboration is a learned skill, yet it's not in the curriculum of our medical, nursing, or midwifery training, and it should be. Now, lest you think that midwifery is the sole answer, it's not. We must do what other industrialized nations do, which is focus on the real primary care providers in our society, the mother and the father. We must support women that have that awesome responsibility of bringing forth a new generation. This is serious business. They must have leave from their employment with pay. They must have parenting support, childcare, and on and on. In short, we must place more importance on this singular, most important event in the lives of our people and of our nation. When Maternity Center proposed the establishment of the Demonstration Birth Center in New York, alarms were sounded that, oh my goodness, we'll have them opening every 10 blocks. What a great idea. Women and family centers every 10 blocks. I wonder if it would cut down on the need for police every 10 blocks to bring under control the rising crime rate. So these are my three principles. Support the education of midwifery and integrate it into the delivery of care and childbearing families in America. It's past due, way past due. Focus on the needs of the mother and the family for the most important thing that any of us ever do, which is to assume the responsibility of birthing and parenting the next generation. And if you don't know how to do it, listen to women, they'll tell you. I was doing a workshop once, doing a section on marketing, and said to the group, you need to find out what the women in your community want. And this hospital administrator raised a hand and says, yes, but how do you do that? I looked at him stunned and said, you asked them. Start health care reform at the beginning, at this critical juncture in the lives of every human being, so that a domino effect on the system as a whole may be realized. I'm absolutely convinced that women, those powerful people in our society, will push those dominoes right on down, and you won't have to worry about the rest of the system. I'm going to tell you a little story. Do I have time? A colleague of mine at Frontier School of Midwifery and Family Nursing, which is a distance learning program for midwives and family nurse practitioners, And she works in Wisconsin in a urban medical center as a midwife. Now, it's very hard to work in a medical center as a midwife. You have to understand that. It's very hard. And she sort of had a reputation of creeping around and, you know, being assigned upon it and then going in and closing the door and putting a chair up against it so nobody could get in so she could work with the mother to give birth. And this medical student had heard about her and he wanted to know what she was doing, so he caught her out in the hall one day and he said, "Can I go in with you?" And she said, "Well, I'll have to ask the mother." So she went in and asked the mother, and the mother said, "He can come in if he doesn't say anything and he doesn't touch me." And so he agreed to that, and he went in and stood in the corner. And Catherine did her thing with the mother. She was in the shower, you know, getting a massage with the midwife, and she was on the toilet, and she was walking around, and she was doing this and that, all the things that they do that are not very mysterious. She was just trying to cope with labor. Then the mother said to her, she was in transition and getting ready. She was beginning to feel the grunting sounds, and she said to Catherine, "I would really like to have some ice chips." So Catherine went out to get them, and the medical student scurried after her and said, "Looks like she's getting ready. When are you going to get ready?" And Catherine said, "What do you mean?" He said, "Well, you know what I mean. Get ready." And she said, "Well, no, I don't know what you..." He said, "Well, you don't get ready. You've got to get her in the delivery room and drape her and do all that kind of stuff." And she said, "Oh, you mean the dead cockroach position? We don't do that." "We don't do that." And he said... And she, meanwhile, Catherine is trying to get the ice back to the mother, and this student, medical student, looked totally bewildered, and said to her, said, "Well, I don't understand." So she said, "I had to stop and give him my 60-second lecture on the physiology of birth and how it, you know, how you really had to, the mother had to work with the baby to get, carry this thing off and so forth, and you had to give her the freedom to do it. And so that's why she's going to stay right where she is, and she'll do what's her thing, and she'll give birth, and we'll catch it." And after she got all through the explanation, he looked at her and he said, "Wow, you ought to tell the doctors about that." So that's my point for the fact that we need to train to that. Now, it's possible that we should have learned all of this stuff in kindergarten, but it's not too late to learn it now. Mounting evidence supports it. A gathering storm of public opinion, and if you don't think there's a gathering storm out there, you're not paying attention, is demanding it, and surely this nation, the wealthiest in the world, can afford it. Thank you.
Received the Martha May Elliott Award for Exceptional Service to Mothers and Children in 2006. She is a nurse midwife, anthropologist, educator, administrator, advocate, and courageous crusader in maternal and newborn health. Known for her work in developing the freestanding birth center model, by the mid-1970s, Ruth was director of the Maternity Center Association, and in 1975, against massive opposition from the medical profession, she opened the country's first state-licensed birth center in a Manhattan townhouse. Next, in 1988, she opened a birth center in the South Bronx, one of the poorest neighborhoods in the city. After receiving a MacArthur Fellowship, the first nurse to do so, in 1993 she moved to Washington, D.C. and established the Family Health and Birthing Center, which offers the best of health, maternity care and support services to the city's poorest families, and where she serves as founder and chair emerita. For 2 years, Ruth has served as an expert consultant to the Assistant Secretary for Health in Washington, and she has received numerous awards, honorary degrees, and special recognitions to honor her outstanding service and work in bettering the lives of women and childbearing families. Ruth is going to share her presentation with Alvina Edwards, a mother here in Washington, D.C.
Alvina's going to be right here with me, because what I really would like most to happen, and we're running out of time, is for you to hear from her about what the service meant to her. But you all had on your chairs a brochure, and you had a graph of the outcomes of the center. So you can look at that. Now, I was planning to show you slides, but I won't do that on the savings that eventuated from those outcomes. And the savings on cesarean in the year 2005 came to $284,592. The savings on preterm birth came to $567,600. The savings on low birth weight came to $300,859. Now, that was $1,153,051 we saved for the system in 2005. Our operating costs that year were $1,074,014. We saved more money for the system than it cost us to operate. We saw none of the savings. We're hanging on, raising half our budget every year because the Medicaid managed care keeps it all and will not listen to our pleas. The city has tried to help us some. And this is a situation that it obtains across the country. There is a good graph which shows that birth center birth on a national level costs $1,872. For vaginal hospital birth with no complications, $6,973. For vaginal with complications, $8,963. For cesarean with no complications, $12,544. And for hospital cesarean with complications, $15,960. Is there a reason why the Congress should listen to this? There is a reason. What I just wanted to go through a little bit of what a man named Ron David, who is a neonatologist, has said about at some hearings that were held on infant mortality. He went into the fact that he was the head of the Joint Center for Political and Economic Studies National Commission on Infant Mortality. He recruited commissioners, educators, journalists, social scientists, nurses, and physicians, and public policy experts. Distilling the essence, and I'm quoting from him now, of our lengthy deliberative process, the commission set out to revisit and challenge conventional wisdom and offer an alternative analysis and perspective, including implications for care, research, and public policy to improve maternal health and infant mortality. In formulating a more comprehensive and complex perspective, the Commission turned to the concept of relationality. Relationality is a concept that asserts that human beings are by nature interdependent, relational human beings. Anything that undermines the human experience of healthy relationships threatens growth and survival. Tears in the fabric of relationships are what make childbearing and child-rearing such hazardous travails. Said differently, infant mortality is a direct consequence of social injustices. Justice is the social form of love, and injustice is the social form of fear. And no nation, no community, no family or child can grow, let alone survive, in the tainted soil of fear and in its social expression called injustice. He went further to advise people to visit the Family Health and Birth Center. He said, if you want to see justice as a social form of love in action, go to the birth center. If you want to see children survive to see their first birthday in an otherwise toxic social milieu, go there. Go there and break bread with the women. Listen to them, talk with them.
learn of their hopes and fears.
Learn of their hopes and fears, their plans and practices. Learn from the stories they tell about themselves firsthand. You will learn far more from them than you can from the studies reported about them. Do not begin or end your quest to address the tragedy of infant mortality in a university or for-profit healthcare system. Go to All Ruth's house.
Okay. So now you talk about what it meant to you.
I have three children. I had my third at the birth center. It was such an empowering experience. Having all three of my children was very empowering for me, but at the birth center, it was way more comfortable. I wish I had all of my children there. At the hospital, it was okay because of the fact that I didn't have any complications and anything. I didn't use any epidural. I had all natural births. But at that hospital, they kept asking me if I needed something for my pain. And I'm trying to labor. I'm trying to do this naturally because it's a natural thing, you know. I always knew that I was going to have a natural birth. I knew that I wasn't going to have any type of intervention. So it kind of, like, took me away from my focus on what I was there for, which is to have my baby. And they just kept asking, do you need something? Do you want to take this? And I'm like, okay, let me focus on having my baby. At the birth center, it was like I was so, like, tense because I'm thinking, oh, they're going to tell me when I need to push. They're going to tell me I need to stop pushing. But at the birth center, they let you do what you need to do, and that's labor. So, you know, you have so many different options. You can walk around without any, you know, encumbrances. You can eat. I mean, you can do whatever you want to do, and when it's time for you to push, you just push. So when it was time for me to push, I knew it was time for me to push. I was like, I need to push. And she's like, okay, Alvina, just go ahead and push. You know what you're doing. And I'm like, oh, it was like a breath of fresh air. You know, my shoulders were relaxed. I relaxed a little bit more, and I had my baby within like 2 hours. So, you know, I didn't have to stay. I was okay. I wasn't sick, so I could go home in a couple of hours.
And who delivered that baby?
Oh, that was Judith Crone.
No.
Me.
Yeah. Judith assisted you.
She really did, because I was looking for her and waiting for her to tell me, all right, come on, it's time for you to push. But she didn't say push, but she wasn't counting. She wasn't telling me to breathe. I just did everything basically on my own. I felt like I was in control. I didn't have to wait for anybody to tell me what to do. So I think having your baby at a birth center is so much better because you are in control, and it helps you to relax because you don't have that anxiety when you go to a hospital and they have to tell you when to push, when not to push. How can you stop pushing? If any of you had a baby before, you will know that when you have an urge to push, your body is going to naturally push. So how can you stop pushing? So having a baby at the Family Health and Birth Center was a very great experience for me. I'm now working there as a breastfeeding peer counselor and a doula. And now it has inspired me to become a midwife and to also open up a birth center. Thank you.
Now, why do you think we get the results we get? Urban Institute is interested in studying us because people say to me, Ruth, you can talk about this, but they're your numbers. A third party has to show that this is really an effective way to reduce disparities, because you have the graph, we have reduced disparities. And I also wanted to say that Linda Randolph, who is the president and CEO of the Umbrella Agency, because we have three service providers in the building. We have the birth center. We have a social supports organization, which is actually a Healthy Start site, and we have early childhood development in the same building. We are setting healthcare in its social context where we feel it needs to be. Linda, you want to stand up so you can see it? That leaves you about 30 seconds for questions, I think.
If
anyone has any questions, could you write them on a piece of paper quickly, please, clearly, please, and send them up with whoever you want to answer them. And if there aren't any questions, well, we'll have you speak from the floor, but we haven't got, the trouble is we haven't got any microphones down there. Do you want to come up and ask a question? Thank you.
I just had some involvement in Pennsylvania. were the Amish midwives, the women working on the Amish. And my perception there is that those women who have for many years worked in a system where they all know each other, they seem to work very well among each other. Do you perceive, because you're talking about education, do you perceive a possibility of how that they are midwives that are good midwives among their own people? Or do you think that they need to, in order to be legitimate, do you think that they have to go to a school of law?
I'm not sure I understand your question. Do I think they all need to go to a school, a formal school for training, all midwives? No, I think there are many different ways to learn. I think that you have to be able to demonstrate how it is that you learned and what it is that you learned, and that there have to be some standards that have to be met in that process, even for the midwives attending the Amish women, which is a group unto themselves that would like to have their own people be their midwives. I think we have a responsibility then to educate those women to the best of the ability that we can. I think different settings require perhaps different types of education. I think that if you're going to work in a hospital and be part of the team that fixes the problems that come in to the hospital, you have to be a little bit different kind of a midwife. I think if you're going to be a midwife who there's nobody during that whole childbearing year, the mother is not seeing anybody else, you then become her primary care provider, and you need to have a background in primary care. In addition to the fact that she's probably going to want to come back to you anyway for her primary care and gynecology and so forth. So it requires, it sort of depends on what you want to do. If you think of midwifery as just catching a baby, that's one thing. But if you think of family-centered maternity care, that you're the primary care provider walking into a home at any given time, and what are you seeing in that home? Are you only seeing the pregnant belly and the perineum, or are you looking at what's happening in the dynamics of the family? Do you recognize child abuse? Do you recognize domestic violence while you're in that home? The premise of the selection of the nurse midwife was based in the early days by Mary Breckenridge and by Maternity Center on the assumption that the nurse in this country would be a public health nurse, because that's the essential ingredient, is the public health nurse. We've lost a lot of the public health in the nursing training today. And that is a part of why the problem emerges about what to do about it. But I think that in the midwifery education, we need to restore it. But as far as pathways to midwifery is concerned, I think a number of pathways can be developed. You know, we thought when parents stayed home and wanted to homeschool their children that they were crazy, and that it was going to be inferior, and everything was going to be wrong with it, and they were neglecting their children. And then it turned out that those kids fared just as well and even better than the kids that went through the structured programs of our schools, and particularly as if the school system that they were in happened to be deteriorating. So I think what we need to look at is you know, what kind of education did you have, where did you get it, and is it complete enough then to call for the practice, scope of practice that you want to do? And I think when we regulate, we need to regulate according to scope of practice.
Any more questions? Okay, Bob over here.
Some personal comments. I trained in Argentina and I did my rotation in OBGYN, surrounded by a bunch of young nurse midwife students and two senior midwives. And sit with the woman, etc., during labor, and then when it was ready to test the baby, she would waltz in, test the baby, and that was it. But it was a very totally different system than reverse, and we didn't have this tremendous number of C-sections and forceps.
That's considered to be high risk just because of where they live and the color of their skin. So we take people, we take families that come into us and give them prenatal care. A few we transfer, it's just beyond our ken to manage. But the point that I wanted to make is that in the past few years, we've now had about 25% of the women who are eligible for birth outside the hospital. But wanted, and it's growing slowly, but I just wanted to make the point that when a woman needs hospital care, the midwife goes with her and takes care of her in the hospital. We do not send the families off to strangers.
For me, it's the production of embryos, and because of EGP over and over again over the years by both public policy people, private foundations that have studied it, everything, report that we need midwifery care in our system to get the outcomes that all of the countries that do better than we do for less money than we spend are getting. And yet, we can't produce them because there are too many barriers to it. And I don't know whether you were here for when I talked about those barriers. But that's a major paradigm shift for the flow of money and for the dominant profession. That's a major paradigm shift. But can we do it for the sake of the next generation? Do we have the guts to at least try it?
I just wanted to say that when I came down to Washington, and I came here with my MacArthur stipend because the worst outcomes in the country were here because the Congress was here. And I went to see my own congressman, Charlie Rangel, and he said, "Ruth, what are you doing here? Harlem's my beat." I said, "Charlie, you take the Congress to Harlem and I'll be in Harlem." So what we're doing is we're trying to educate the Congress because they don't understand. They really don't understand, and we have to get to their staffers and we have to teach them about the benefits of this kind of care. And that's what we're working on. The AABC is working with the Family Health and Birth Center, with the ACLM, and we are making a real effort to educate the Congress people about this. And I feel hopeful about it. I really do, because the hearings that were put on, where Ron David spoke, were put on by Representative Cohen from Memphis, and he said when the hearings were over, he said, "Well, you need to work with this woman." He told the neonatologists and the researchers and so forth who had come from Memphis, and I think he got what we're trying to do, and not just because we're saving money, but because
I agree with Ruth and Kitty. I think we need to leave the job of hospital and take care of the people who are actually sick and who need therapy and stuff like that. Pregnancy and having birth is the most natural thing in the world besides breastfeeding. That's the second most natural thing.
back to those things. We live in a society that is like everything has to be convenient. So now they have the electricity test. It's so convenient. But what is the outcome of these things? That's what we're talking about now. What is going on now? It's changing. So we need to go back to from the beginning of time. That's what we need to do.
I want to say, look out, because there's an octogenarian takeover here.
I think the biggest barriers, besides the fact that we've traditionally always had, we don't have a healthcare system, we have a healthcare industry, and what the cost is also a profit. And so there's the cost versus profit and competition for money and the culture, you know, the culture. And we have to get, I'm so proud of all the octogenarians here, but we got to get more young people. We got to, I don't know, we got to get into the young culture, because most of the people who get pregnant and have babies, and we need more young people in our profession. And so it's a big question, but culture is the country that the river runs through, and culture affects everything. So we have to have that too.
The other thing I think is for you, since you asked the question here in the audience, I just would like to quote Bill Cosby. Come on, people, stop talking about it. Talk about it, talk about it, talk about it. Go back to your communities and say, why don't we have midwifery here? Why don't we have birth centers here? I just went to this presentation and everything they told me, all this stuff, I didn't know. I'm a health professional. How come I don't know this?
I'd like to say one other thing. I think there's some tables and things in this handout. And Americans think, oh, we have the best health care, you know, and the only thing that's wrong with it is not everybody gets it. But in fact, that isn't true at all, and we actually have rising low birth weight, rising preterm, rising maternal mortality, and people don't have any idea that it's not just that, whoa, some people can't afford health care. In fact, the people who can afford health care are getting lousy health care too, and they're getting more of these interventions too. So it's quite shocking. It's quite shocking to actually say, hey, maternal mortality is rising in this country, and I found that when I've talked to people about nitrous oxide, well, that's shocking. How can we not provide something that is available in all these other countries and is much safer than what we're doing? So that there's just a lack of information, and when you actually tell people some of these things, they just can't believe it, you know? It's not just that healthcare costs too much. Even if you can afford it, getting an unnecessary C-section is bad. And I was talking the other day, and somebody said, are you telling me, because we're working on healthcare reform in Oregon, he said, are you telling me that doctors are actually killing babies and mothers? And people are like, what are you going to say? Yes. You know, it's a shocking thing. But it's not just that not everybody gets care. That the care is bad in a lot of cases. What do you think, Charlie?
And the name you heard caused you to set the guy on your mind. Some of you heard this before. One of my favorite quotes nowadays is by Lily Tomlin. She says, I try to be as cynical as I can, but I just can't keep up. I really don't think, as much as I would love to think, that our profession, I mean, the obstetroids, are going to change and do the right thing just because we all want them to do the right thing. I am really, you know, we've all put a lot of thought into this, and I think we're really going to have to regulate this state level, and the docs will yell, "Oh, that's cookbook medicine." Well, we could use a little cookbook medicine right now. And our Medicaid program's already considering it in Florida because we're in big trouble. And if you want to do a section, you're going to have to call ahead and get approval. Well, that's going to drive people nuts. There are other ways to do it. One's by setting standards, expecting people to meet the standards, and that would be for how you do inductions, how you do cesareans, who gets submitted to the ICU, and then tell them ahead of time that we're going to audit you at the end of the year. And if we have cases where you haven't met the standards, you're going to have to pay us back. I think that's better than having people try to call in, because that's going to be tough if you really do have an emergency. But I think we're really going to have to regulate the Medicaid program, show that we can save money by doing that, and then hopefully the private health insurance industry will be informed by that and come along.
I just want to thank you all very much. I need to say that, you know where the word research came from? Because we knew it before, we lost it, and now we have to find it again. That's what we call research. As a family physician who delivers babies and backs a birth center for 25 years in a rural place, I want you to remember there are babies born everywhere, but not in certain counties anymore. This is the first time in human history that you can't be born in 65% of the Appalachian Regional Commission counties. You have to go somewhere else. Born in caves, born on ships coming across, born in covered wagons, but you can't be born in Claiborne County, Tennessee. So with that and all these messages, I think there's a matter that we have to take firmly at heart. I really appreciate